Call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. We have an agenda out today, and we will follow the agenda. So we'll start with a public hearing on House Bill 2106. Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, members, House Bill 2106 deals with school district bonding. What it does is to allow a school district with voter approval of a construction bond that's greater than $1 million to change the construction site after the bond has been approved. It would require the district to do a safety evaluation for safety improvements for the new site before the bonds would actually be issued for constructing at that site. It basically addresses a situation when a school district may get voter approval for a bond or perhaps more than one construction site, and before that bond is actually sold, they find another site that would actually be better than the original site.
Okay, but this doesn't change how much money can be spent or anything like that. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, no, but it does require that the bond be for at least $1 million or more.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll find out more about this from our Honorable Treasurer's Office. We have a delegation, Michael Salvaggio, Cynthia Burns, and Carol McCoog.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer, and we come to you with House Bill 2106, which we hope that you would pass out today. I believe that the description given to you is fairly accurate. I just would like to underscore very briefly, this would not allow project sites to be changed if they were specified in the ballot title. So this is not granting school districts some additional authority to move specified sites around after they've been voted on. This is only for prospective sites, and I want to put that on record because the House Revenue Committee had that same question.
Can you tell us what problem we're actually addressing here? Were there some situations out there that led to this bill?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Carol McCoog, and I'm a partner with the law firm of K&L Gates. We serve as bond counsel to a number of state agencies, as well as local governments and school districts, and currently I am serving as chair of the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission. Madam Chair, to your question, the problem we're trying to address is one of a timing issue. The 2007 law that was adopted requires school districts that seek voter approval for these large construction projects to conduct the safety evaluation on potential sites for school facilities, to conduct the safety evaluation prior to the bond election. And the problem that a number of school districts are running into is that the site evaluation for school facilities is a fluid evaluation. So in many cases, they may identify a more appropriate site for school facilities, either because of subsequent environmental investigations. In some cases, sites will be donated to them. In other cases, a site will become available for purchase that is actually more cost effective. And the timing requirement of the safety evaluation to occur prior to the election creates an awkwardness for the school districts to take advantage of what's potentially a more appropriate or cost effective alternative site. So what we are proposing is to allow a school district to conduct the safety evaluation prior to a bond issue, but after the election should an alternate site be identified. And I want to emphasize that we're certainly not eliminating the safety evaluation requirement and simply trying to address the timing issue.
So they would still have to, I see here, they would still have to do the evaluation before they actually issue the bonds.
Okay. Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Did you want to speak?
Okay.
Any questions from the committee? No, looks pretty straight. Senator Morris?
Why is it limited to at least $1 million bond? That's the lower threshold.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Morris, the original 07 legislation had this definition of a large construction project as a $1 million threshold. I'm not privy to why that threshold was originally contemplated, and certainly we're not in any way in this bill trying to tinker with that the policy behind that limitation or that threshold.
To your knowledge, has there ever been a bond issued for less than $1 million for a school?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I'm not aware in recent years of a bond measure. It is more common, as members of the committee are probably aware, for a school district to go out very infrequently and ask for a large bond measure for multiple school facilities, and which is why ultimately the sites are being the analysis for the sites are fluid.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have you thought about the
one-room
schoolhouse too?
All right, Senator Telfer. I know I'm old, but nevertheless. Mm-hmm. All right. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Okay. I don't have anybody else signed up. Does anybody else want to talk on this? Okay. Close public hearing. House Bill 2106. And open a work session on House Bill 2106.
Senator Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2106 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved House Bill 2106 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objections? So ordered. Senator Hess is our education guru on this committee. Would you like to carry this?
The honor to.
Thank you. Okay, now we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2107. Thank you, Steve. Good afternoon, Madam.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2107. House Bill 2107 comes to you from the other side. Your counterparts on the House side went through the Revenue Committee and had a couple of hearings, and what it at the House bill itself, it actually goes into the statutes and changes a couple of things. They takes the requirement that a board that might go without submitting the question of a pledge to the electorate of a district when they're going for a bond takes that out and requires everything to be subject to those elections. It also includes in your page 2, sections 3 and 4, whole section about the repayment of bond and using the proceeds to do the swap on interest swaps and so on. And it has different cleaning language that is in page 4. Line 32, and then you have on the page 5 as well. And in general, it becomes more conforming bill to statutes and language. And as you would see from the history of the measure, on the House side, it went on the consent calendar. Usually, there is opposition from the House Revenue Committee of sending things in the consent calendar. However, this one was able to win that kind of prize. However, you have also in front of you a -1 and a -2 amendments. And those amendments slightly try to inject language that you would find is taken. They're about identically the same, with the exception of the last page that you have. And I believe one of them would be the one that is chosen. And I understand from talking with the state treasurer, actually with MDEC outside in the before the hearing, that probably would be talking to you about the Dash 2 amendment. And the bill, still, as we haven't seen the Dash 1 or Dash 2, so we don't have fiscal on those, Madam Chair. But we do, from the original bill, don't have any revenue impact, but we have a fiscal statement that might or might not be the same fiscal for the Dash 1 or Dash 2.
Thank you. We will invite the same team up again, Michael Savalgio, Cynthia Burns, and Carol McCook.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer, and we bring you House Bill 2107 from the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission. In 2007, various bonding fixes were passed by the Revenue Committee on behalf of the Oregon Law Commission and the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission, and certain items and certain technical fixes were not addressed, and the committee at the time acknowledged that if further changes were required, that the we should return in 2009 and request them, and so here we are. We requested amendments addressing the use of qualified zone academy bonds by school districts, which was, as council suggested, inadvertently left out of the original bill, and a slight change to ORS 294 allowing certain uses for general obligation bond levies. And legislative councils presented us with a Dash 1 and a Dash 2 amendment, which, as staff has indicated, are substantially similar. Legislative council has recommended adoption of the Dash 2 amendments in a letter that was provided along with those amendments, and we would certainly be fine with that, and would ask that you adopt the Dash 2 amendments and move the bill. And I will allow my esteemed colleagues to delve deeper into the inner workings of some of these items.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Carol McCoug, and I'm currently serving as chair of the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission. As Mr. Salvaggio mentioned, in 2007, the Oregon Law Commission and the MDAC co-sponsored a bill that was drafted in consultation with LC and staffed primarily by a number of public finance professionals throughout the state to consolidate and streamline the bonding statutes for the state and local governments. As a practitioner under the statutes prior to the 07 bill, I will say that the statutes were getting to be quite unwieldy and were sort of a result of some patchworks that have been done over the years and cross-references to a variety of different definitions around the statutes. And the Law Commission bill, the MDAC bill, really brought together a number of concepts and streamlined the statutes. However, as Mr. Salvaggio mentioned, now that we've lived under the statutes for a little over a year, there are some things that we are looking at in terms of technical corrections to the statutes that we'd like to propose. I would say that they are under the nature of things that were inadvertently brought in under the 07 bill, things that we are technically correcting, cross-references and things that we like to correct, and some things that with the hindsight and perspective of the recent credit crisis and are looking at the statutes that we would like some clarification on some of the language that's there, again, with this perspective of the way that the credit crisis has affected the bond markets and our ability to issue bonds. So I'm happy to answer any questions regarding any specific sections of the bill or Dash 2 amendments.
If you could just help us understand the difference between the Dash 1 and the Dash 2. In the letter from Legislative Council, there was some indication that there might be some resistance for some reason from the Dash 2 amendments. What's the difference?
Sure. Madam Chair, the Dash 2 amendments address two different statutory corrections, and the one correction that is the same with respect to both of the amendments have to do with the way in which a school district can levy its annual general obligation bond levy to take advantage of tax credit bonds that have been, the allocation has been increased, and another type of tax credit bond that the federal government has created under the federal stimulus package. The way that tax credit bonds are issued, they are structured as federally taxable bonds, and then the investor will receive a tax credit. The structure of those is what we call a bullet principle. All of the principal of the bond is paid at one time, as opposed to what we're more traditionally used to seeing in the tax-exempt market of a serial bond where you issue a $100 million bond and every year some principal is coming due and you're paying it down annually. The taxable market doesn't like that structure. They want one $100 million bond due and payable in 14 years or in 15 years. When a school district is levying its GO bond, they don't want to levy one massive principal payment on the taxpayers at the time of maturity, but rather they would like to take the principal amount and annualize it over the number of years that until maturity, so that they are levying level annual levies on the taxpayers where they got voter approval to do so, so that they can then save up those levies and pay the one bullet principal. That is the correction that we've made to the statutes to address that is common in both the Dash 1 and Dash 2. To address your question about what the difference is, there is a statute that authorizes school districts to issue these tax credit bonds. And in 2007, unfortunately, the 07 bill inadvertently removed one of the two paths that the school districts could take to issue these tax credit bonds. We are reinserting that second path. And I think there was a difference in the way in which we could reinsert that path that was inadvertently removed. I had a nice discussion with Legislative Council yesterday about the two separate ways in which that path could be reinstated. I think there was merits to both paths. I think he acknowledged that one path was one way to reinsert it was perhaps a more technically from a technical perspective something that may be preferred, but from a practitioner's perspective may not be consolidated as well with the new statute. So he, I think, proposed the two dash amendments as a way to acknowledge that either one would achieve the same purpose, and acknowledging that the practitioner, myself, and others that I consulted with would prefer the Dash 2 amendments.
So you say that this is in the Dash 2, but not this subject matter is in the Dash 2, but not in the Dash 1. What would be the alternative way of addressing this issue?
Madam Chair, I actually think the substantive matter is reflected in both, and it's just the way in which the implementation is occurring is different in the Dash 1 and Dash 2.
So the subject matter, the effect of it is the same in both of them, but just the way you present it is different in the Dash 2?
Madam Chair,
in other words, in the Dash 1, would you still have these two paths?
Madam Chair, yes, we would. The Dash 1s, I think, might require a little more study in terms of the way in which it's using terminology that is not defined in the school district statutes that are being addressed here. I think the intent would result in the same, have the same result as the dash two, but from a technical perspective, I think the dash ones would require a little bit more study and perhaps a little bit more some tweaking to it. We would be in full support of the dash twos, which has a very, from our perspective, very clean cross-reference to a definition that was well thought out and discussed during the 07 Law Commission bill process.
Okay, so where would the resistance come from if someone were to prefer not to do the dash twos?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, we don't know where the resistance would come from, but I would respectfully defer that question to Legislative Council, who brought up the issue.
Okay, well, we won't be moving this bill today because we don't have our paperwork anyway, so, and I want to have the committee have a chance to look at these amendments, so we will pursue that closer. Senator Telfer.
Is the issue more with the use of the definition of full faith and credit basis for these bonds repayment versus just referring to an ORS that defines it better?
Through the chair, Senator Telfer, I believe, and don't want to speak for Legislative Council, but I believe the concern is that there's a cross-reference to a definition that we believe is clear, and perhaps Legislative Council would more fully like to include a description, if you will, of the concept, as opposed to the cross-reference to the definition, which we believe is a little more cleaner.
The cross-reference to the constitutional reference?
A statutory cross-reference.
In addition to this constitutional? Now I'm confused. Where's the statutory reference in the dash two that you're referring to? I see a constitutional reference, but dash two.
Madam Chair, in dash two on page four, the bolded language, revenue bonds as on line 16, revenue bonds as defined in ORS 287A.001.
That's in the dash one. Oh, I'm sorry. I had them mixed up here. That's part of my problem here. Okay. All right. So that's what you're referring to, rather than just the broader constitutional reference.
Correct.
Okay, now I get it. I had it in reverse order, committing my apologies. Okay, well, that makes it much clearer. All right, any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we will, anybody else want to talk on this one? We will close the public hearing.
Madam Chair,
Senator,
like there was somebody who wanted to speak.
Does Mr. Phillips want to weigh in on this? Let's have him up here.
Welcome. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. John Phillips with the Oregon Department of Revenue. I just saw these about 10 minutes ago, so I'm just getting a first impression. The interest of the Department of Revenue is that we administer local budget law, which is Chapter 294, and this amends local budget law. We have, to my knowledge, have not been included in the discussions, and so I'm trying to make a real quick analysis here. My concern would be with on either the dash ones or the dash twos. Let's look at the twos. I think you were more interested in the twos, which would be on page 3. Lines 10 through 16. The bolded language from this page and the earlier page, I think, more clearly state what was being deleted on page 2. And it seems to be an improvement. But what's added on lines 10 through 16 appears to be a new kind of indebtedness, maybe not new in terms of indebtedness used by municipal corporations, but a new in terms of this particular statute. This statute talks to municipal governments about what they can estimate as being the amount that they should levy for taxes. And there are three categories in this section. One is for anything under the permanent authority, local option authority, or the bonded indebtedness authority that is unlimited by the Constitution, Article 11, Section 11B. And everything flows quite well until you get to that part, and that's the part I'm not 100% sure of. I don't know that, without legal counsel's discussion, that bonded indebtedness, quote, on line 10, that is a tax credit bond or other bond includable in gross income under the Internal Revenue Code, I'm not aware that that's not subject to the limits of Article 11, Section 11B. So I'm not sure that they would want to include that in their estimate. And without talking to counsel, I just would like some time to...
Okay. Thank you for bringing that up. We will give you time to do that, and your comments will cause me to put this over till next week instead of trying to bring it back tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
We'll give you more than 10 minutes next time. All right. Is there any questions from the committee before we leave? Thank you. And if you would kind of put your heads together if there is an issue here. Okay, thank you. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2107 and open a work session on Senate Bill 690. Good afternoon, Chris.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. You have in your packet a Dash 5 amendment to 690, which for the most part was similar to the Dash 3 amendment that the committee discussed the other day, with two differences, and they are in Section 9 of the bill on page 8. This is the section that refers to the consumer reporting agencies and the DOR providing them some information. Subsection 2A is rewritten in the Dash 5 amendment. So, and it just replaces the section entirely. So, just reading from the Dash 5, lines 16 through 19, it now reads, notwithstanding ORS 314.835, and subject to the rules established by the Department of Revenue, if a taxpayer has neglected or refused to pay any tax and has not filed in good faith an appeal to the tax court within the period required by ORS 305-280 contesting the tax, the department may, and then it goes back to the original bill. So the difference here from the discussion the other day was the ORS reference, which has been corrected to 314-835. And then in the something that was different is the language pertaining to a petition before the department, and they actually don't do that. Nowadays, they appeal to the tax court. So that wording has been changed in the Dash 5 amendment.
Okay.
And then the other change in the Dash 5 amendment is the Section 8 there of the Dash 5 amendment. And that is an applicability section for the portion of the bill that modifies ORS 305-437. This is where the word damages gets changed to penalty. And that was in response to a recent tax court decision. And so what the Section 8 of the Dash 5 amendment does is apply that change to all appeals pending on or filed on or after the effective date of the act.
Okay. Thank you for that. Any questions on the specific amendment from the committee? Okay. Chris, could you now, we've gone through so many conferences and iterations and work sessions and hearings and everything else on this. Can you just kind of summarize for us now what the bill would do in total with the Dash 5 amendments?
Sure, Madam Chair. The Section 1 stays as is, and it allows the Department of Revenue to disclose taxpayer information to local law enforcement agencies under certain circumstances. The bill also expands the department's ability to disclose information to the State Board of Tax Practitioners and the Oregon Board of Accountancy. It allows the department to share particulars of tax returns with those two bodies. It also clarifies that the Oregon Tax Court may impose a penalty in cases of frivolous arguments. That's just changing the word damages to penalty. Mm-hmm. And it allows the department to report to consumer reporting agencies certain information regarding delinquent taxpayers. And then it requires the Department of Revenue to provide advance notice to the taxpayers if they can. And it also, and this was an issue, I guess, that came up last time, in the bill on page 9, subsection 4, it requires the Department of Revenue to notify the Consumer Reporting Agency when the delinquency has been resolved. So those are the pieces of the bill that remain in the dash 5.
Okay. And go ahead.
I was going to say, you have in your packet, you have the revenue impact statement and the fiscal impact statement. The fiscal impact shows a minimal expenditure. The revenue impact shows a revenue gain of about $100,000 per biennium, and that's mainly due to the leads that would be generated from the compliance work. The information going to the reporting agencies is permissive, and the $100,000 is kind of a long-term expected value. Any amount that the department would collect would probably come in lumps depending on those particulars of a given taxpayer. So it's kind of an average, as opposed to trying to assign when there might be zero impact in the biennium or perhaps a big impact. It's kind of a long-term average.
Okay. All right. And committee, you'll note a big something big missing from this bill, which is the data match concept, where you try to match tax returns against bank accounts so that you can figure out if people are actually have the resources to pay their money or in some cases haven't filed. This concept needs a lot more work. We have cooperation from the bankers and from the Department of Revenue to work on this in the interim. So you will not see it on Senate Bill 690, but I think Senate Bill 690, even though it's narrowed down, would help the Department of Revenue in some of their compliance issues. So are there any questions on the bill as amended for Chris? Because I would like to move this along. Senator Telfer.
Well, I still have the concern with the local law enforcement, and I've had some conversations with people involved with local law enforcement, even the media that has covered them, and says local law enforcement has no respect for personal confidentiality. They'll use DMV records to find out, you know, some young gal that they want to find their address or something. I'm really concerned about tax information going to the local law enforcement. I know in Bend, Oregon alone, we have a number of law enforcement people who have found their way on the front page of the paper because of some violation of the law. And I just, you know, I can see the current is subpoenaing that information, but to give that information, I really am concerned about the confidentiality of the information when it's just turned over to local law enforcement.
Okay, I don't...
Page one.
I know, I don't know quite what to say, because behavior you require is not legal. I mean, that you refer
to
is not legal.
So. And we're talking about small communities, particularly in the rural area on the east side of the state, where, you know, you have small towns and you have a local law enforcement that has, you know, all this information, and you're not sure how it's going to be used. So,
okay. Senator Morris.
Just as a follow-up, would the disclosure come before a grand jury proceeding?
It says or.
Put my. Chris, do you have any insight on that? She'll be solely for blah, blah, blah.
Might be a good question for Deborah.
Deborah, do you have any insight on this? Trying to get my judiciary hat back on quick here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Deborah Buchan with the Department of Revenue. The existing language authorizes us to disclose information when it's for purposes of investigation or prosecution of violations of criminal laws relating to perjury, theft, or forgery. So, and that's with the filing of a false or fraudulent return. So there would need to be some investigation ongoing where someone is investigating criminal violations. We have had very few instances of where we felt that it would be helpful in those investigations or prosecutions to involve local law enforcement. So we don't see this as a wholesale disclosure of tax return information to any local law enforcement agency. But if we are investigating, or if the Department of Justice is investigating avoidance of tax evasion, or fraudulent returns, and it would be helpful in that investigation to be able to talk to local law enforcement about information that we have regarding a particular return or information about the taxpayer, that would be the purpose for this particular provision.
Yeah, and you know, before or after grand jury, not everything involves a grand jury. I mean, you can have charges filed without the grand jury being convened. Any other questions while Deborah is here?
Well,
Senator Telfer.
So what do you do now?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, what we do now is only involve those that we're authorized to disclose to, which would be the state police, the district attorney, a grand jury, but not to local law enforcement. So we simply can't disclose, even though we think it would be helpful in an investigation.
These are very limited, right? I mean, this isn't something that you just have. You turn over massive amounts of taxpayers.
Madam Chair, I'm aware of only fewer than half a dozen cases where we would have wanted to be able to involve local law enforcement in an investigation.
Okay.
So which direction is the involvement? Are you asking local law enforcement for information on a person that's not in compliance, or are they looking for information about a person's tax information who they're investigating? Innocent until proven otherwise, they're just investigating this person.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, we are asking for assistance from local law enforcement in the investigation. We are not responding to requests from local law enforcement for tax information to assist them in a drug enforcement activity,
okay.
For example.
Follow up then. So if you're asking for information from local law enforcement, why do you need to convey tax information?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, because if we're looking at whether or not a return is fraudulent or investigating fraud, if we can't talk to local law enforcement about what we're investigating, what we think may be fraudulent behavior, if we can't even talk about what is on the return or actually who even filed a return, we're not able to involve them at all in our investigation.
Could you give us a for instance?
Madam Chair, you heard Director Harshenko presented the tax compliance report. There was a discussion about a recent criminal case involving a contractor and a great deal of unreported withholding tax and inappropriate payments to workers and so on. And in that particular case, I don't know the details of it, but we would have involved local law enforcement in that if we had been able to disclose information to local law enforcement, but we were not.
Okay. Yeah. I'm still questioning how their involvement is going to help you determine whether this tax return is fraudulent. In that case, it was not turning over trust funds.
Could it be something like the contractor was found to be illegally employing great masses of workers or something like that?
Madam Chair, it's any information, because we cannot even talk to them about the fact that we have an investigation going on, because the tax return information is confidential, and we interpret that to mean also that the records that go into the information that goes into the return is confidential. So we're not even able to disclose the fact that we are conducting an investigation.
Hmm. But you don't turn over somebody's W-2s and all that stuff to local law enforcement when you do this, do you?
We don't now, because we're not authorized to disclose anything.
Well, I mean, let's pretend it's state police. What have you given to state police that you now want to give to law enforcement?
We're looking for
Madam Chair, just the fact that a return has been filed and that there is information on it that would indicate that it's a fraudulent return. Again, this doesn't happen often, which is maybe why it's hard for me to come up with an example.
And then, so these investigations are done through the Department of Justice, right?
Correct.
Okay. I mean,
Madam Chair, there is limiting language in lines 18, 19, and 20.
Yeah.
They cannot disclose under current statute for any alleged crime unrelated to the fraud issue of tax returns or the
I'm comfortable. I mean, they've been doing it with the other law enforcement. I think if you, you know, there's probably potential for corruption in any of these outfits, and I'm comfortable with having it in there with the limitations.
Well, but just as a curiosity, Senator Telfer mentioned somebody, and it came in the news, a 1041 facilitator out of Bend that walked off with a whole ton of money. How would you approach that? Is that
a 1031?
Excuse me, the tax codes. But in a 1031 facilitator, how would that play in this law?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, that's a very good question. The question would be, has that facilitator filed false or fraudulent tax returns? Presumably they may have if they had embezzled funds and had not reported that on the tax return. So in that case, we would be looking at a false or fraudulent return. And if a criminal investigation was pursued by the Department of Justice, we would be able to disclose that tax return to show the income had not been reported, the embezzled income had not been reported. So that would be a potential use of that information.
I'm still having trouble understanding this flow of information. How does it help you determine whether there's a fraudulent tax return by giving the local police information about a tax return? I don't know how it helps you to determine whether a fraudulent tax return has been filed or under reporting of income. I don't see where that happens by you giving information to the Bend Police Department about this group of...
Well, Senator Telfer, as I understand Deborah, they can't even reveal that they have a tax return without this authority. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. And if I may, Senator Telfer, the criminal work is done by the Department of Justice. I don't believe it's the Department of Revenue that's making a determination if there's a criminal violation here. And in order for the Department of Justice to do the investigation and pursue the work, they need to be able to see the return to see that it rises to the level of fraud.
Well, I'm very close involved in that case, and I just can't see how the Department of Revenue turning over information about a tax return that may or may not have been filed by any of those individuals or their company or companies, how that helps the Department of Revenue. I can see where it might help the local police, but I also know that community. I know those people on a personal basis, and I can tell you what that could do to some people living in the area when there's innuendos and things have not been settled as to who's has there been wrongdoing and who's responsible and the extent of that wrongdoing. So that's a perfect example to make me more and more cautious. And I haven't heard a good justification on why this is in here, why the Department of Revenue should be able to give the Bend Police Department information about their tax returns that's going to help the Department of Revenue.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, I'm not suggesting that we would be providing information to the Bend Police Department. I think in that example, if we needed to involve the state police, we can disclose the information under current law. There would be an investigation, I believe, undertaken by the Department of Justice. They would gather information in order to determine whether there were criminal violations that should be asserted, and investigated and pursued, we would be able to share the information with the Department of Justice. If the state police needed to be involved, if they needed to be involved, we could share the information with them. But certainly, if the Bend police don't need to be involved, we would not disclose the information to the Bend police, regardless of whether this statute is here.
But I think where the problem is here, you're not taking tax returns and turning them over to the Bend police so they can riffle through them and find out whatever they need to know. Is that correct?
Absolutely, Madam Chair, that is correct.
So it's just basically finding out, because you want to find out, because if they embezzled money and didn't pay their taxes, that's a criminal offense under tax law, isn't it?
As far as I know, yes, Madam Chair.
And that's a perfect example. So if, in fact, they embezzled money and the police discover that, why would you be giving the police information about a tax return? It's not up to the police to determine whether they underreported their tax return. That's why I say I don't understand.
She can't even talk to them about that they're investigating if they don't have the authority.
I don't see the purpose. That's my whole point. I don't see the justification. I see no reason to do it.
The existing statute, I believe, makes it clear it's for the purpose of investigation or prosecution of the violations. So once you've identified a problem, you engage the Justice Department, and I don't know how this layering occurs between OSP and sheriffs and local city police, but to the extent that that group could work together more effectively to prosecute or investigate it, you obviously have to have cause to start this proceeding, right?
Madam Chair, yes.
So it's just another tool in the toolbox to investigate and prosecute, is the way I would see it.
But a tool for whom?
Well,
the state.
Yeah, the problem here is we've had this in statute for a long time with these other law enforcement agencies, and there's never been an issue come up that I'm aware of. And so if you extend it to local law enforcement agency, you're talking about the same kind of an operation, the same kind of authority, the same kind of tools. It just happens to be local law enforcement. And if you think that local law enforcement are uniquely situated to abuse their powers or whatever, then
do.
Yeah, and that's illegal, and I can't go there. So, all right. I think we've exhausted this topic.
Thank you. Chair.
All right. Any other? Oh wait, Deborah, why don't you stay there in case there's other questions? Any other questions or concerns about this? Okay, committee. I think I'd like to move this bill along through the process. And Senator Morris, if you're comfortable moving the -5 amendments.
Are we in a work session?
We are in a work session.
Madam Chair, I move the -5 amendments to Senate Bill 690.
Senator Morris has moved the -5 amendments to Senate Bill 690. Is there any discussion, objections?
I'm going to object. I'm happy with this bill except for the inclusion of the local.
Do you want to consider supporting the -5 amendments and then voting against the bill?
Sure.
Okay. Without objection, the -5 amendments are adopted. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 690 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved Senate Bill 690 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Would you please call the roll, Anna?
Senator Hatch?
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Senator Telfer?
No.
Senator Morris?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
Aye. Okay, the bill is approved, and I will carry it. Okay, now we will open a work session on Senate Bill 880. Good afternoon, Dr. Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You have for Senate Bill 880 an amendment that we described at your last meeting but didn't have. So now you have it. That's the -3. I can go through that with you. Also, you have a revenue impact statement that based on the -3. And Before we proceed, I wanted to mention one thing, and just from the national tax reports that Massachusetts just ended an amnesty. New Jersey begins one on May 1st, and there are ongoing amnesties in Connecticut, Alabama, and Arizona.
Wow.
So it's a thing to do. The Dash 3 amendments, to remind you of the key elements to it, and Section 1 directs the department to develop and administer a tax amnesty program from October 1, 2009, ending November 19th, 2009, or a seven-week amnesty. There is a little phrase in there, because of the 91 days after signee die, that it would be either October 1 or 91 days, whichever comes later. The department is directed to publicize the tax amnesty program through appropriate outreach and media activities. I know the work group had a lot of discussion around that, and also you've had some discussions about that with Sally May and Dave Fiscom, representative, and I know he has some thoughts on that if the committee would like that input. Section 2 identifies the programs that are eligible for the amnesty, and they are the personal income tax program under Chapter 316. This would exclude the withholding program, but would be overall personal income taxes. 317 and 318 are the corporate income and excise taxes. ORS Chapter 118 is the inheritance tax. And 267.385 is the transit payroll taxes. So the tax years that are eligible would be those are prior to January 1, 2008, that begin prior to January 1, 2008. So it would be 2007 tax years and before. If you look down on line 25, you can see the specifics of the carrot for taxpayers. If they pay their taxes in full, they would receive 50%. They would be, the department would be able to waive 50% of the interest that would otherwise be due. So if they pay in full and 50% of the interest, then they would be... all of their liabilities would be eliminated. There would be no penalties. On the top of page 3 is the key language for restricting who is eligible, and that is a taxpayer may not participate if prior to the starting date the department has issued a notice of deficiency or has assessed a tax. So this is the key phrase that eliminates the those that are already determined to owe taxes, and in which the department has contact with, and in many cases has a payment system developed. Sub 5 there goes through the installment program, and in the installment program there is a you would be paying interest over that period of time, actually through May 31st of 2011, and that interest, you notice in the last line there, line 30, shall be reduced by 50%. And one of the things that in talking with the department wanted to make clear was that this 50% applies to interest that would be due on the date you entered the installment program, but also would be 50% of any interest that would accrue during the installment program. So it would be apply to both time periods. The installment program, again, must end May 31, 2011. Full payments must be met. If they are not met during that period, then the 50% advantage on lower interest payments would be eliminated, and what interest that would be due under current law would then be due. So in other words, the waived 50% would be reestablished. So Section 4 sets up the post-amnesty penalty, which is equal to 25% of the total amount of unpaid tax that is otherwise due. And that 25% would be in addition to any other penalties that would come into play under current law. Section 7 lays out the creation of the tax amnesty fund. and all monies received by the department during this period will be put into this tax amnesty fund, and the fund shall be used to reimburse the costs of the department. So the department can incur costs really beginning with the start of the biennium up until the end of the amnesty period, and then can reimburse itself through proceeds in the amnesty fund. They'll have to go before the emergency board and have those costs certified and approved by the emergency board, and they can get reimbursed up to $1 million of certified costs. The you do have a fiscal statement too, and the fiscal statement basically says that similar to a hall pass, this bill does have a subsequent Ways and Means, that they will look at it again in Ways and Means, but they're assuming that the $1 million, that the cost will come in under the $1 million cap. On your revenue impact statement that you have, the dash three, I've tried to go through kind of some of the arithmetic and the different funds, and I'm kind of taking guesses at the timing of some of this. The amnesty fund that's established, I would assume there'd be roughly $12 million during the 09-10 period and $4.7 million in the next fiscal year as those installment payments come in the second year of the biennium, and for a total of $16.7 million in gross revenue into the fund. The estimated costs are $1 million using that number that's the cap, would give you a net into the amnesty fund of $15.7 million. Basically, this is pretty close, very close on the personal income side to our estimates from 2005. As you recall, those 2005 estimates were derived from the Michigan 2002 program, which they had detailed information on revenue that come in from non-filers and from those with amended returns. Since that's what's applicable here, those numbers were available, the proportion based on Michigan's income tax collections relative to Oregon's. But I updated those numbers for Iowa's 2007 amnesty, and that's where I got the estimates for the corporate along with the personal. And the Iowa collections through new and amended returns in 2007, I took that proportion of their total collection. Their collections were about $3.6 million. They collect about $2 billion in 2007, so that's about 0.18% of their collections. I applied that ratio to Oregon's $5.4 billion projection for 2009 for our personal, which was about $10 million. Then the corporate, they collected about $6.8 million in their corporate collections, very close to ours in size, $323 million. We're projected to have $326 in 09, so those numbers came out very close. That was about 2% of their collections. So we add those two together, and that produced the estimate of $16.7 million, basically on that proportion to Iowa. The other components on general fund, we had gone through and done these estimates in 2005, and I've updated them just a little bit, modified them somewhat. The assumed collections under current law would be department being able to track down folks that would come forward in the amnesty, either through amended returns or through compliance efforts. Given the compliance study and the results of that, I did reduce that number a little bit from 2005. Revenue from penalties is just a rough estimate of what would be coming in from those individuals as they are tracked down by the department. And the new revenue from identified taxpayers are based on proportions from a previous study that was done on Michigan about the percentage of identified taxpayers who stayed in the system and that percentage of revenue that was ongoing. So all of those net out to a relatively small number for general fund of about $1.8 million going forward, primarily as a result of those new taxpayers that are identified. I do think another thing that I don't have in here, I don't think I could really quantify, but I think would be a potential real positive in terms of compliance for the Department of Revenue, would be the characteristics participants that respond. So you get an idea of what, you know, what are the kinds of sources of income, and might give the department some additional information in the future to help them with compliance efforts, particularly with non-filers.
Thank you, Paul. I have a question on the dash 3 amendment at the top of page 3, where it says a taxpayer may not participate in the tax amnesty program if prior to the starting date the department has issued a notice of deficiency. I'm wondering if we need to change that to say they can't be eligible for purposes of their accounts receivable, but if you had the same taxpayer who had fudged on their deductions or not declared income during that time, then wouldn't we want to open the amnesty program for that kind of declaration? In other words, this puts the non-eligibility on the taxpayer rather than on the type of recovery. And I'm just wondering if we should change that to make sure that we're talking about, you know, we don't want the amnesty to apply to liabilities that the department has already identified, but if that same taxpayer maybe hadn't filed in previous years or had the need to do an amendment to be in full compliance that the department wasn't aware of, what do you think about that?
Madam Chair, the thinking was that the taxpayer has been identified, and in that process, that discovery process, you'd find out what deductions or what kind of misreporting had taken place on the return. But that may be a question for the department if they
okay.
think that would.
Yeah, we are going to bring the department up on this, so maybe we can do that now. Are there any questions before we bring the
Madam
department?
Chair?
Senator Rosenbaum.
I just wanted to ask, so this period of publicizing this obviously has to take place before the bill's actually passed,
and yes, and they're going to address
that.
About that.
This
has been the trickiest part of trying to get this through for this fiscal year, Senator Rosenbaum.
I might add also, Senator Rosenbaum, this does go to Ways and Means, so that would be we would anticipate a budget note in there that would say the department will incur these costs and then be reimbursed.
Right, and there's a very good question there, too, which I'll make sure gets asked. Deborah, do you want to come up? And Dave Fiscom, you want to come up, just the two of you, so you can be a resource? Okay, Deborah?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Madam Chair, the language that you just discussed on page 3, one way to read that is that this is tax year specific. So it does say a taxpayer may not participate if the department has issued a notice of deficiency or has assessed a tax for a tax year for which they could otherwise apply. So that could be read that if we have sent a notice of deficiency for 2005 or have assessed a tax for 2005, they're not eligible to participate in amnesty for only tax year 2005, but any other year would be open for them to participate.
But that still means that if you missed something when you were looking at their tax return on 2005, like they hadn't disclosed some income and you'd missed it and they wanted to make a clean slate, and I don't know how often this even happens, but I think it would be within the intent of this legislation to allow them to come forward with something that is covered by the amnesty.
And, Madam Chair, as long as we have not discovered that and issued a notice of deficiency for that 2005 year, they would be eligible to participate in that.
Okay, because that's not what this says. This ties it to the taxpayer, so I think we need to tighten that up and just say, they're not eligible for that deficiency, but they are still eligible for other things that that we're trying to get at with the amnesty. Questions? Any other questions? Did you have any other comments about this, Deborah? Okay. Dave, we would like you to address, well, why don't you identify yourself for the record?
Surely, Madam Chair. For the record, Dave Fiscom here for Sallie Mae.
And, Dave, first of all, I want to thank you very much for being involved in the process at our invitation and providing some of the technical expertise that you have. And I was wondering if you'd be willing to share with us today some of the issues around publicizing this program and staffing it once it's done, and the role of outside contractors in this based on your experience.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Happy to do so, and I'd be pleased to be interrupted by your questions. I guess based on my own background in state government for 17 years, though it's a long time ago now, and my own work in my own firm for 19 years, as well as my knowledge of the Department of Revenue, I would say in particular with regard to lines 13 to 15 on page 1 of the dash 3s, which I think was the focus of your staff's question to me, that strikes me as a doable assignment for the department to publicize the tax amnesty program through appropriate outreach and media activities in order to maximize public awareness of and participation in the program. If it were me doing this, I would issue a request for proposal for firms, especially in Oregon, perhaps not limited there too, but especially in Oregon, who are in the business of doing this kind of work. I would anticipate the department would be able to get a quick response from firms relative to what it would cost, as well as how they would undertake this work to assist the department. There'd be a chance also for the department to work collaboratively with such a firm on both the earned media side of the house as well as the paid media side of the house to generate substantial awareness. I recognize as I'm even uttering these remarks, I'm speaking to at least two people who are in the communications business on this committee, the chair and Senator Haas, who's out of the room at this point. So I'm sure you have some perspectives on this too. But if it were me, I would issue an RFP and ask for a quick response and get responses back and allow a competition to yield the best consultant to help the department with this work. I find that to be possible. I find that to be a good collaboration of public and private, but obviously that's the department's choice, and I don't believe they need special statutory permission to engage in such an effort, at least based on your hearing last time, relative to Dash 2. So that's what I would do, and again, I think there's a combination of paid and earned media that can make the public aware of what the opportunity is here, especially when this is directed at non-filers, and I think there could be a chance for success. So it strikes me as a doable assignment.
Thank you very much for that, and it would certainly be the intent of the chair, and I think others on this committee, that we would want, you know, once it's clear that this bill is moving well through the process, that we would want the department to start right away with an RFP process. And of course, you know, it assumes that there's going to be some front-end expenditure, and that's why this is going to Ways and Means. But we need to get started soon. In answer to your question, Senator Rosenbaum, our struggle with this has been the fact that we can't put an emergency clause on it. So all the ducks can't be in order, but it's certainly within the Department of Revenue's statutory authority to apply for outside contractors, and it would certainly be my intent that that they do so at the earliest possible time, and we'll be in constant consultation as this works its way through the process.
Madam Chair, if I could just add one quick comment beyond that, and you've said it very well. More generally, with regard to this piece of legislation, the Senate Bill 880-3, at the department's discretion, I think it's possible to find firms in this country, this region, that have the ability to help departments with non-filer programs. I should add, just for the record, that that doesn't necessarily happen to be a core competency of the firm I represent, to which I add, at the company's specific direction, so be it. That's your call. And as you make that policy decision, we would be pleased to provide you with referrals for companies that we know who are in this business if the department chooses to have help beyond the help specified in lines 13 to 14 on the public outreach side. We've made one contact with one firm that is in this business and would be prepared, if the department chose to proceed in this direction, to submit a proposal in response to an RFP for general consultative help that might actually also be compensated on the basis of the returns rather than upfront costs. So there are options there as well, but Sally May's experience around this country in Indiana and Oklahoma has been in general, more broadly stated, general tax amnesty programs as opposed to a non-filer program. And we're pleased to provide that ongoing counsel if you need our resources to help you in whatever, however you choose to proceed with your colleagues on Senate Bill 880-3. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And these other firms and maybe firms beyond that could also. Another thing I assume we should also consider is outside help with the phone banking part of it, the incoming calls, the outgoing calls, that type of thing.
Madam Chair, absolutely. The amount of traffic there may not be as much as it would be if there was a more general tax amnesty program, but clearly the ability to respond to folks who are getting in touch with you relative to this program is critical. That's half the battle. The other half is persuading those individuals who do call to respond affirmatively by paying a past due debt. So I think staffing, the capacity to respond to those who get in touch with you is absolutely critical. It's one thing to outreach. It's another thing to be responsible for those who to respond to those who actually call you to ask how to participate, and I'm sure the department will take that into account.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any questions or comments? Senator Rosenbaum, are your questions answered in this regard?
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, both
Thank
of you.
You.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morris.
I'm not clear on the RFP. The language obviously is very broad. Undertake any other action. But will the department start out with an RFP or they will just go totally in-house? I'm not clear what direction we're giving them.
We're giving them direction to move as quickly as possible to do an RFP for at least the outreach part of the program, and we'll be considering whether to add functions to that as we proceed. But I think the direction is clear, at least from me, and someone is free to argue if they want. The Department of Revenue is not a PR agency. in fact, sometimes they could use a little PR. No offense, Deborah. But this is not in their area of expertise, and it is a vital area for the success of an amnesty program. If people don't know the program is there, then we can't expect them to comply. So in answer to your question, Senator Morris, the direction is very, very strong.
Okay.
And you're welcome to second that if you like.
I agree with you. The language of the bill allows great flexibility for the department, so I just
Correct.
Make clear what the will of the legislature will be on this to help them.
Right. I see nods from the back of the room. I think the message has gotten through. And there are methods that we have if things don't start moving. Are there any other committee? We're going to hold this over. I don't like to spring amendments on people and have them vote on them that day. So we will hold this over. We'll put it. Excuse me?
Just a question. Nowhere in here does it. I'm not sure required. On page 5, section 7, subsection 3, it does talk about reporting back to the emergency board as far as the cost of this. It would be nice to have in the bill that they must report to the legislature their results. You know, it would be fun to compare this projection to against actual. So I guess I would like to see that in the bill that they do have to come back and tell us what they reaped.
We actually could do that, but our authority is so strong, you know, during the interim to call them in for a report on this, and that's why we didn't put it in there.
Well, I was thinking about putting in there just to kind of remind people that this was a requirement to come back to the legislature and report.
Actually, do we really care if they come back as long as they send the money?
No, I'm real curious about this. Because okay. If we ever did this in the future, it would be nice to know how far off we were. And
Okay, well, let's consider that as we go forward. I don't think there's any question that we are going to have them back in front of us with a report on how this goes. I have a tendency not to put things like that in statute because you might put one date in and it doesn't make any sense, and then you're kind of stuck. But if I thought there were any chance that we would not be getting a report, I would be very concerned.
But Madam Chair, just remind Senator Telfer of our policy of burning our estimates when the session's over and never, never looking at them again.
I can see that.
Ah, yes, the statement of a true veteran. Okay. Well, committee, I'm going to put this on the agenda again, carry it over till tomorrow, and we may or may not be ready to move it tomorrow, but I want to get it going as quickly as we can so that we can get it moving through the process and so that some of these other wheels that have to start turning can start turning. So any concerns you have over the amendments, get to Paul or me, and we'll see where we are. Thank you, and with that, we are adjourned.